Superbrain is a labour of love. Alas, no podcast can survive on love alone. We don't have a sponsor, so we need your support for Superbrain to stay alive and kicking. You can make a one-off donation by following the Support This Show link in the show or episode description.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
My name is Sabina Brennan, and you are listening to Superbrain, the podcast for everyone with a brain. Have you read many self-help books? Are you a fan? Maybe you're not. Do you love them or do you loathe them? My guest this week is a well-respected journalist writing regularly for The Telegraph, The Times, etc. Her name is Marianne Power, and she has also amassed a considerable collection of self-help books. She devoured them, reading some of them multiple times over the years. She loved them and frequently recommended them to her friends and her family, but she never actually followed their advice. And she admits that she tended to skip over the questionnaires and the journaling sections. But after one particularly boozy night left her feeling very hungover, she made a snap decision to actually act on the advice of a different self-help book every month for a year. Being a writer and possibly not yet sober, she decided to announce her intention to the world on social media and also to document her journey through a blog, which ultimately became her brilliant book, Help Me. Written with raw honesty, it reads like a Bridget Jones script, but much, much better, because on every page you recognize yourself and you laugh and you cry and you ask yourself, why, oh, why do I? So, Marianne Power, I am so excited to talk to you today and to welcome you on the Superbrain podcast. It's always very interesting how I end up choosing my guests, because I promised myself that I was just interview people that really interest me or fascinate me, rather than just have guests for the sake of having guests. And how I came across you is kind of another one of those interesting stories. You actually interviewed me for, because you are a journalist, and you interviewed me for a feature that you were doing on Brain Fog.
Yeah.
And we chatted for ages, and ages on the phone. And I remember I hung up, and I just said, God, she was so nice. She was just one of those people that you'd like to be your friend. Now, that's going to make me sound scary, but, you know, it was just lovely. One of those conversations. So I kind of Googled you and did a stalk, which actually probably is something that when you're being interviewed, you probably more professionally should do before you're being interviewed to see who you're being interviewed by. But given that you were interviewing me for the Telegraph, you know, I mean, there was no need, you know, that's kind of your CV up front, straight away, you know. So I looked, and then straight away your book popped up, and I started to read about your book, and I just thought, oh, what a brilliant idea. So why don't you just tell us about this idea for your book? And oh, readers, I can't wait. I mean I've just finished it, I've just finished it. My listeners will know that I leave reading the book right up till just before the podcast, because it leaves me with a lovely fresh sense, you know. Yeah. And often it's right to the wire, you know.
Yeah.
But it just leaves me with that lovely fresh sense of the book. So yes, tell the listeners.
You've been living inside my head for the last
and also I bought two versions of it, so I've actually been listening to you.
I
would recommend that, folks. Actually, the Audible version is lovely, because you really do feel like you've gone on the journey with Marianne. So tell us about this. Because it is it. And I know at the very start, actually, you say, is it your mum says at the start? Yeah. Please don't say you're going to use the word journey.
My Irish mum is everyone's favourite bit of the book. She's in about 25 pages and I wrote a 300 page book. And all anyone asks about is my mum. she reads out her lines actually in the audio book. It's her doing it.
What a fantastic idea, actually, to have had her do that.
And she's such a brilliant sport about it. But yeah, the book opens with mum saying, you know, about this book. And I said, yes. She said, please tell me you won't use the word journey in it. And I said, I won't, I promise. I prefer the term spiritual path, just taking the piss really. And then she was like, oh, Marianne. So the book is about me. I spent a year living by the rules of self-help books. So I took a different book each month on a different topic. So men and money and worrying. And I did absolutely everything they told me to do to see if these books really can change your life. And the idea came, I was 36 at that point, and I'd probably been reading self-help books since my mid-20s. So, you know, I probably had a good 10 years of reading self-help books. I was always quite embarrassed about it. You know, I'd hide them under my bed and friends would, you know, laugh at me. It wasn't a cool thing to be reading anyway. And like, there was one book called How to Stop Worrying and Start Living that I'd read 3 or 4 times. And I was trying to tell a friend about how good it was. And she said, "So you don't worry anymore?" And just burst out laughing because I worried, you know, at that point I worried obsessively. So friends would laugh at me basically and say that I was living proof that, you know, these books don't work. But I really believed they would. And I thought the problem was that I wasn't actually doing what they were telling me to do. So, you know, it was like reading a cookery book and looking at the pictures and going, oh, how lovely, and then ordering a pizza. Yep. So I was reading these books, fantasizing about how wonderful life would be if I got up to meditate at 5 in the morning, or if I repeated positive affirmations. And I would, you know, really read that and get quite hyped up when I was reading the book. But then I'd open the wine and watch Netflix. You know, I never got up at 5 a.m. to meditate, and I didn't ever repeat the positive affirmations. And I used to skip all the journaling sections. You know, these books very often have invitations to journal about the things. I always skipped all the exercises. And so then this is this one particular hungover Sunday, and I spent the whole day watching the Kardashians, and I hadn't got out of bed. And I was just, you know, just swimming in a pool of sweat and self-loathing by the end of the Sunday. And I picked up a book that I'd read so many times before called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And then I just had this idea. It just came to me, you know, just spend a year just doing the self-help. Stop reading these books. Actually do what they said. And because I had a journalist background, journalism for me has been a really good way to go and make me do things that I wouldn't have the courage to do myself as my own personal human. You know, journalism has made me go into strange situations. And so I decided that I would blog about this. So I declared it on Facebook, this is what I'm going to do. And I'm going to write about it as I go through it. And so that was my way of being accountable. And then the book came a year after that blog. So that's the story.
Yeah. And so we do. And I'm sorry, Mum, but we do go on that journey with you, you know. it's so honest, you know. It is really raw and honest. And the funny thing is, it's about self-help books, and the title of it is Help Me. How, and there's a, what I should have it.
Some heading, I think, is how self-help did not
change my life. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, actually, I would argue that it is probably one of the best self-help books I've ever read. Because it kind of is, because it is this really honest. It's just this honest, what you let us inside your head and inside your heart, and you try everything. Now, obviously, it really is a book. Actually, the subheading should be "Don't try this at home, folks," because it actually is quite dangerous.
Exactly,
because it is dangerous. Because really, essentially, it should have been, you know, you really, to do those things, it should be a book a year kind of thing, you know, because if you had done Susan Jeffers, that's the, she's the Feel of the Fear and Do It Anyway. If you had done her for a year, you know, that could have been absolutely life changing. But essentially, so Susan Jeffers' Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, that was quite a hot book when I was younger. And I actually hadn't read it, but it was it became a catchphrase, you know, when I think that came out around 1987 originally. And I had got married in 1987. So some friends were reading it who weren't married, but I was busy kind of trying to, you know, save up for carpet for a concrete floor. And, you know, and then I was pregnant. And do you know what I mean? I didn't have time for that. But also there was things, and people were just always saying, oh, just feel the fear and do it anyway, you know, and it just had become this kind of catchphrase. But you actually really did stuff every single day, which was, because I was going, whoa, hold on, that's just too much for every single
day. It was too much, actually. But yeah, so I wrote a list of the most scary things I could think of doing. And I shared that list on Facebook. And, you know, the most scary thing I could think of doing was stand-up comedy, which I did do. And I also did naked modeling for an art class.
I think for me, that was the naked modeling in an art class, I think, would have been the scariest for me.
Okay.
But the amazing thing was you discovered actually you were really quite good at stand-up comedy.
So, just to let listeners know, on the other things on the list was to chat up a guy on the tube, which anyone who's been in London, you're not even allowed to look at other people on the tube, let alone talk to them. Stand-up comedy, public speaking, which is something that's known to scare most people more than death. Like, they've actually done surveys on that. And it's the top fear. And the naked modelling. But also I had little things like opening bank statements. This is it. And so this is what Susan Jeffers says. I actually think Feel the Fear is just a brilliant book. She suggests that we do one scary thing each day and that we start with something very small. So it can be opening a bank statement or parallel parking. And she says that the rush that you get from achieving this thing is it gives you an energy that then makes you go on and do the next thing and the next thing. And she said nothing is as bad as that kind of just feeling that you're not dealing with the things, you're not doing the things you need to do. And because it's almost like you're sending yourself this message that you're not able to cope with the world. And she said nothing is as bad as that feeling of putting things off. And that when we do anything, take any kind of action, even if it doesn't go well, like my first parallel park was terrible and there was a man in a van laughing at me. It was kind of, you know, all the stuff that I didn't want to happen happened, and I mounted the pavement and I came home feeling like a hero because I'd even given it a try. So yeah, actually, she says there's no way of losing in those situations. Yeah. Because even if it really falls apart and you get such a feeling of satisfaction. And so I learned that those small things actually have a huge effect on your whole feeling of power and confidence. And then, so then I built up to the big things, which was the naked modeling and stand-up comedy, which came at the end of that month. So that was the very first.
But your first thing was on New Year's Day. And yes. you went sea-swim. Swimming in the freezing cold. That's
in
big.
In the freezing cold. And I would have very easily not have done that. I was already trying to procrastinate out of it, and my flatmate at the time is just one of these very low-key people that just gets on and does things. And she said, no, you said we'd go swimming, we're going swimming. And she was there, you know, with the towel over her shoulder, and because I looked at look out at the gray sky and it's like, oh no way, we're not doing this. I changed my mind and we did it, and it was fantastic. It was freezing. I thought I was gonna have a heart attack. And it's a siren, and London sirens came out like just with heart pounding and feeling so
wonderful
alive.
But you see, that's what's amazing. So I always look at these things from a neuroscience perspective. I think that's what's interesting about these books, because you do really write a thesis in a sense on self-help books. You know, they're kind of, because you discuss them philosophically as well, you know, and the dangers of them and the morality of them as well. It's very interesting. And I agree with you about a lot of things, and that's how I felt about a lot of them. But from a neuroscience perspective, the basically what Susan Jeffers is getting you to do is to tap into your reward system in your brain, because when you do something, when you surmount a challenge, it taps into you get a release of dopamine, which then releases, it taps into the pleasure centers of your brain and the reward. So you get this sense of reward, but you see that also becomes addictive, and it tells you, I want more of that. That was good. Uh-huh. That's the way it's set up. So it's then, oh, let's do that again, or let's do something like that again. Brilliant. So it's really good. And you see your brain by nature, your brain likes patterns, right? Which is why we fall into patterns and routines. But in order for it, and it needs to understand, in order to understand the world and make predictions, it needs more novel information. Even though it likes patterns, it needs novelty to be able to improve its predictions. It sounds counterintuitive. So you've got to keep doing new things in order to improve its predictability. So that's why doing new things is rewarding, because your brain needs you to kind of go and do it. It's part of adaptation. So I'm always kind of looking at these things. Yeah. And the thing that I want to write about is that, why do some of these books work, even though they're talking absolute rubbish? So for the most part, they've kind of, it's a bit like Freud from my perspective, right? From a psychological perspective. Freud described some very true human behaviors, but the reasons he gave for them are they're just pulled out of the sky. They tell us more about his psyche. Uh-huh. And they've never been proven. And it's that real case, as it is with self-help books. You just have to believe. And if you don't believe, well, then you're sort of not doing it right.
Yeah.
And that goes totally against psychology and principles of, you know, you've got to scientifically, you know, the scientific method, and you've got to understand how these things work. And so I think with a lot of these self-help books, they've tapped into a process that actually does work, but then they've made up things like angels and various other things that make it work. And that's where the problems arise. So then you moved on to another book that actually I thought was really good, and that actually, if you'd kept with it, I think could have made huge differences, because one of your big areas
I know what's coming.
A walking financial disaster.
I am. Yeah,
well, at that time, are you still a walking financial disaster?
Yeah, I am. So the second book I did is called Money, A Love Story by Kate Northrup. And it's a book that tries to help you understand your emotional relationship with money, because she says that most of us just think our problem with money is that we don't have enough of it, and if we just had more we'd be fine. But you only have to look at lottery winners who end up broke within, you know, a few years to realize that's not the case. The issue is not how much money we have. The issue is very emotional, and it's connected with what we think we deserve in life, what we think we're worth, and our childhood associations with money. So, you know, if you grew up in a house where money was the root of all evil and rich people were, you know, selfish, bad people, then that really affects how you're going to respond when money comes your way. It's going to affect how the things you go after. I really definitely could have spent a whole year doing that book for sure, because money is, it's such a painful subject if it's something that you aren't managing well, which was the case for me and still is the case for me. It's quite a lot of work to get to the bottom of that and change your habits. And one of the things that she says is a really good question that I've asked lots of people since, and it's very revealing, but it's, what is your first money memory?
Yeah.
And how does it relate to how you are today? And when I ask people this, everybody has such a different money memory, and it really, really corresponds to how they behave with money today. And so my first memory was my dad, who was a builder, coming home. And, you know, this was the 80s when we were kids, so there was always cash. No one had cards. And me and my sister were in the sitting room watching telly after school. He came in, and he was a messer. So he came in and he threw notes from his wallet. He threw notes up into the air. They would have been like, I don't know, we probably had pound notes at that point. I don't remember what notes they were. Threw them up in the air and said to me and my sister, we could keep whatever we caught. And of course, the excitement of this we were jumping up and we were, you know, trying to grab things in the air. And I just remember feeling so stressed that I was going to mess this up. And, you know, my sister was taller than me. Was she going to get to them first? And, you know, and then afterwards, he said, only joking, give it back. And, you know, just this feeling of like, oh my God, what an idiot I was to believe that we were going to get to keep that money. And I mean, I think afterwards he probably would have given us some money anyway. He was really generous. He was just messing with us. And,
yeah,
you know, there would have been no harm intended. But I think in that moment, how it connects to me in the book and also now, much less so now because there's a lot of awareness around it, but the patterns are still there. I think money is to be thrown around. Like, if I have money, it is dispensed everywhere. And yeah. I think you never get to keep it. So what's the point in looking after it? It's going to go somehow. And it's funny, when Help Me came out and, you know, it was really quite successful and it was published all around the world, I was absolutely convinced someone was going to come and take the book advances away from me. I thought there'd be some legal issue.
Yeah.
It would not be mine. I didn't believe the money was mine in a way. It's you know, these things go very deep.
Yeah.
And
particularly when they come from childhood.
Yes. Yeah.
If you want to find out what your authentic self is, you need to understand how your brain has constructed yourself.
Yes.
Because your brain has just constructed this idea of self, who you think you are, from billions of bits of information that it has collected over the years. And,
yeah.
And essentially you have said this throughout this book. Do you know what, yeah, I mean? And that's what you've been doing on this self-help journey. You were picking out these bits. Ah, that's where I got that bit of me that has to do with money. Do you know?
Yes.
So that's kind of very true. And as you said, oh, now I'm really aware of it, but it's a very embedded behavior. And
exactly,
that's very true. And that's part of the awareness, Jerry. Understand where it is. But then you actually have to do the practical work on changing the habit.
Yeah.
And that's actually really actually much more easily done than finding the original behavior. It really is just retraining a habit, but you have to singularly focus on it and kind of work on it. But it actually really is just like training for a marathon. You know, you just actually have to, well, marathon is too big, but in your instance, it might be. You really are just replacing a long held behavior with another one. You need to yours has become automated. So basically, I won't spend too long on it, but yeah, I think I spoke about it actually in our brain fog conversation. It's just become automated. So you need to replace it with another one that you can automate and watch out for in times of stress, etc. You'll fall back on that old behavior.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, for all of us, there's that right across points in our lives. There's things that, and they've just become our story, which is our story of who we are.
Yeah.
And again, it's just a story that our brain has pieced together. And that means we can take it apart and write a new one, you know?
I'm just thinking of a funny example, which isn't to do with this book, but I have a story, you know, that I'm not good with numbers, and that's tied in with money, but it's also just tied in with numbers generally, and that I wasn't good at maths at school. Mum, this is a while ago, was moving out of her flat, and so we were clearing things out, and I was going through old school reports, and I found one about how great I was at maths. And, you know, like, so this story that I had constructed somewhere along the way wasn't always true. I don't know if it's even true now, but it was just like, oh,
I was good at maths. Where did I get that one from?
Yeah.
It's so mad,
isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, like,
you
say, that becomes the identity of, like, this is, you know, this is who I am. This is what I'm good at, what I'm not good at. And also what I realized in the process of a self-help journey, sorry, Mum, is I am capable of so many more things than I ever imagined. So the public speaking and a stand-up comedy, just to go back to Feel the Fear, I did so well at it.
Yes.
Now, at that point, I didn't speak up in meetings. I was a writer. I stayed behind a computer. It blew my mind that was something I was good at. I really, it like shattered my whole idea of who I was and what was possible. And the feedback from everyone was like, you're a natural. That can't have been your first time. And it really was. And so, what I realized doing these self-help books, and things happened later as well, that we're so limited in our ideas of ourselves and what we can.
But we take on one comment.
Yeah,
it's one piece of information.
Yeah.
And it's not that we take it on, because who are we? Our brain takes on one piece of information and adds it in without checking the validity of it, the value of it, or whatever. Yeah. I mean, I remember thinking for years I had really ugly feet. Because I have a memory that when I first met my husband and we were out for the, you know, dating, you know, in a summertime and sitting down, I can't even remember where or when it was, and him saying, "Oh my God, your feet are so weird," or something like that. Yeah. And then I remember, you know, years later, we were married years at this stage, doing something or other, and I said, "Oh, stop, don't look at my feet, they're horrible." And he says, "You've gorgeous feet."
What are you talking about? Yeah.
And I said, "No, you told me when we met I'd horrible feet." "No, I never did. I've always thought you've got gorgeous, elegant feet." Yeah. I don't know where that came from. But but I had sort of hidden my feet for years because of one little comment.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe sometimes we even dream some of the things. I have no idea.
Yes.
Yeah. But it could be, because sometimes you can have really, really real dreams and you wake up. I know at the moment with the heat, I'm having really crazy dreams, which is quite normal. But we should move on because this is so fascinating. So was the secret the next one?
The secret was the next one.
And I'm so cool. With you on that book.
And it's very telling that I did that. So 1 month of financial reality, and then I flipped instead of, and I did have.
Yeah, I think they were kind of. You were making progress on the money.
I could have, should have really stayed with the money another month, but instead I flipped to the absolute opposite of reality, which was the secret. And the secret says, I mean, lots of your listeners will know the secret because it's, I think, still one of the best-selling self-help books of all time. And the secret says that we can have anything we want in life if we just believe. And there's a slogan: what you think about, you bring about. And so if you want a Mercedes, which I did at that point, the idea is you go to a car showroom and you sit in that Mercedes and you feel your hands on the wheel and you feel the leather and you really believe that car is yours. And according to the secret, somehow that is actually going to come into your reality. And with money, there wasn't much talk about, you know, checking your bank statements and earning, you know, working hard. There was this a blank check that you can download from the secret website, and you print off this blank check, which is from the universe, the bank of the universe, and you fill it out for the amount that you want. And the idea is that if you believe it will happen, it will come to you. And of course, the get out is that if it doesn't come, it's because you didn't really believe.
It's your fault.
So this
That's
is
what I don't like about these ones.
It's a very,
That's what I really it's, don't like. It's a very yeah, blaming perspective.
I was and still am very conflicted by the secret, because in some ways I do believe magic is possible. I've had experiences of just things that were just wonderful and just fallen into my lap, and I do believe that when we open our minds to what's possible, you know, wonderful things can happen. And I was deeply uncomfortable with this message that when bad things happen, it's your fault. There's a part in the book that talks about if you're, you know, in a war zone, it's because you're on the same frequency as that event. There's an implication that if you are sick, that's because something in your thoughts is causing that. You know, it's very heavy stuff to lay on people's, you know, feet.
Without anyone to counteract or counterbalance the content in the book. So someone is reading this alone in their own house and maybe having very bad thoughts as a consequence of it. And someone may be reading it from starting from a very low place in their life, and then reading that, it could have very poor consequences.
I think if you're reading it at a low point, it gives you such hope because it's so wonderful. You know, when kids, we have that feeling of I could be anything, and you know, often it gets knocked out of us along the way. But you know, I want to be a ballerina, and I want to be an astronaut. And this book asks you, what do you really want from your life? If you could have anything, and it tries to encourage you to not come up with all the excuses that you normally would of, you know, I can't be a ballerina because I don't dance. They're like, if you want to be a ballerina, be a ballerina. And I loved that opportunity to actually really think, what do I want? And it made me realize I didn't know.
Yes.
You know, all I knew was what society had told me. So there's one of the exercises is a vision board. And a vision board is, you know, you take a big piece of cardboard or a pin board and you pin up pictures of everything you want in your dream life. And I started doing it and I started putting on these pictures of like houses in LA. And I put on a picture of Blake Lively, who's this beautiful actress. And I put on pictures of these, like, you know, I don't know, the Mercedes went on there and these beautiful outfits. And I realized when I was constructing this board that it was making me feel stressed because I didn't fit into this dream life I was creating. Like the friend I was living with came
home. Rachel, that wonderful. Yeah, she's a wonderful. She's a voice of reason and reality in the book. It's fabulous. You have this amazing cast of characters in the book.
Yeah.
I just want to say this in case I forget it.
Yeah.
Somebody please buy the rights to make this a movie, because I think it would make a movie, a fabulous movie. Has anyone?
We can come back to that later. We've lots of conversations around that.
It would just be an amazing movie.
Oh.
Can I play your mum?
she's the most important character, no doubt about it.
No, I'm joking.
But just with the vision board. So I put on this, you know, dream LA life. And then Rachel comes home, my flatmate, and it's just like, this is so not you.
Yeah.
And that was...
This is what the world says success looks like.
Exactly. And I had never, ever sat down and properly said, what would a life look like that you really wanted? I just had never done that. And so I think it's a really useful exercise. And then I made another vision board that basically had, you know, pictures of my friends, and there was pictures of, you know, places to go traveling in. And there was a woman meditating on it. So then there was a picture of a courgette salad for some reason I put on in the middle. And then my sister looked at that and she's like, you do realize you could just buy courgettes. It doesn't have to be a manifest fantasy. Them. You could make it reality right now. But I never did go and buy the courgettes.
I remember, like, I grew up, you see, a lot of people think these, you know, a lot of these books are new and modern and there's a resurgence now. But like when I was younger, these were, and I remember trying to do the visualizing and at that period of time, I really, really, since I was eight, wanted to be an actor. Uh-huh. And, you know. But I wasn't allowed to say it out loud. Again, you talk about you talk about these things. Now, when I say I wasn't allowed to say it out loud, so I mean, my parents, my parents sent me to drama classes and were very proud that I won competitions and all sorts of things. But I couldn't say it out loud that I wanted to be an actor professionally. And I actually didn't know that people could be actors professionally. Yes. Do you know what I mean? I didn't know that. And also my father would have been, he was 42 when I was born. So, you know, he would have been born like in 1921 in Ireland, do you know? So basically he would have seen, you know, actors as the next profession to prostitutes, you know, do you know that kind of way? Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, because going way back, that would have been the profession in the theatres and those kind of things, you know, kind of. Medieval times and all those things, that kind of thing. Anyway, why did I say that? Yes, so at the time I did eventually follow my dream, you know, when I was in my late 20s and I had two children, wonderful timing, and I gave up my day job to pursue my dream to be an actor, and I had qualified as a drama teacher and I was kind of teaching drama and trying to pursue acting whilst trying to pay a mortgage, and I had a husband as well, but and bring up kids and all the rest, and I was manifesting that fabulous house in LA white with glazed windows and the swimming pool and my career as an actor, you know. And I'd say a lot of us were trying to manifest that same house, which is why none of us got it, because there wasn't enough houses for us. do you know? And I, you know, I was doing all the thing. I remember the universe provides, and you know, we were trying to make sure there was enough money to go around, you know, on our earnings, and I'd given up my job, and I did get a place in you know, in full-time drama school. And actually, I would have ended up going there at the same time Colin Farrell did. It was in the same place, and I had to turn it down because I said I can't afford the fees, and they said, oh, we really want you there, and we'll waive the fees. And I said, yeah, but you're not allowed work while you're there, and I need to pay my mortgage. You know, it was kind of all that sort of thing. Anyway, I did become an actor, and I worked as an actor, and I worked in TV here in Ireland for 10 years. I worked in soap, and so I did kind of manifest that part of the career. But I remember, you know, doing stuff like, because I was always quite frugal with money, and I am, you know, my parents were frugal with money, and I was thinking of your first memory, you know, and we, a little bit like you, the first memory that came to mind was getting some money for the first time in my life, because we never got pocket money. All my friends got pocket money, but we were never given money. You don't earn money as a child, was, you know, we don't give you money. If you need something, we will get it, but you don't get money to spend every week. And basically, sweets were bought in the shop for a Saturday night, like a little quarter pound of chocolate sateens or little boiled sweets were bought. Whereas my friends got money that they could go to the shop and make a decision what to spend
themselves.
And I remember the very first time, I think I was early teens, that I actually got money to spend. And I remember going into the Dandelion Market. I had picked out the pair of purple dungarees that I wanted to buy. And it was the very first time I was going to be able to buy something on my own for myself. And when I got into the Dandelion Market, I had lost or stolen, or the money had been stolen from me. Yeah. Now, that's my first memory. So I've always been really careful and frugal with money. Oh, I remember going home and just crying and not believing that it had happened. Yeah, it's one of those ones, isn't it? I was reading the book, I was thinking, gosh, is that why I'm always so frugal?
Yeah,
and careful with money. And it's only actually really only in the last year and moving here that I kind of sort of said, no, I can spend money on having my house nice. It's in the bank and it's kind of okay. And I mean, I'm, you know, heading towards the last stage of my life, but I've always been really, really careful with money, whereas I have siblings who are real risk takers. And I know if I had taken risks, I probably would have way more money, but I've never felt that I could take a risk with money. I've always made sure, when we got married first, I would have envelopes for everything. The complete opposite of you. Well, I've worked out the mortgage is this, the shopping is this, and each week I would put, you know, if it was 750 goes in there, and that means we'll have enough every week for everything. And I presume it comes from something like that.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Anyway, the vision boards and all that. And I did all that as well. And it kind of didn't manifest. And I'm now actually, my next book actually is really going to be around all this stuff, which is why it fascinates me, you know, to kind of really go to the core of the neuroscience. Because I do believe there is something. And like you just said there, magic happens. And I think it's not magic. It is neuroscience. It's just we don't understand what it is that has happened, what it is that we've done that has allowed that to happen.
Yes.
That's what interests me, you know. And I do think that it's not helpful to say, I think it's very religious. And like you, I'm Irish, and we're brought up on that that yeah. that guilt, that Catholicism, you must believe, and all the rest, and it's just a way to control you, and it's anything that says if you don't believe you're not doing it right just does not get my vote, and I think it's a cop out, and that's why in these books, you know, where anything that says you just have to believe, I'm all for believing yourself, that's entirely different. But basically, if something isn't working for you, well, then you've got to give the person a step back in and say, well, hold on, maybe you're pursuing the wrong thing. Maybe what you think you're looking for isn't actually really what's right. Maybe you need to take a step back and look and see. And actually, even for me, that's what you discovered. And what you discovered there was, you know what, that big huge White House in LA actually isn't what makes me happy. Yeah. Actually, it's my friends are what make being happy and are what are important to me. And that's the thing for me. And I'm going to skip on to, because I don't think we'll, and we would spoil it as well for all of the listeners, because you have to buy this book. Like,
oh, thanks.
It's just so fabulous. I do want to skip on to Tony Robbins, because yes. I remember discovering his book and reading his book, and it is a tome of it, and I can still see it. It was green, I think, the version I bought.
It's huge, isn't it? It's a really huge. Thick book.
And I remember being, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, thinking this was absolutely amazing. And really now all I think about the man really is, have you not got enough money? Have you not made enough money out of these people? Like, tell them about the event that you went to, how much it cost, yeah. how many people were there. And this man must be a billionaire at this stage, surely.
So the Tony Robbins event, Tony Robbins is this kind of, he's like the archetypal of an American self-help guru. Like,
he's a giant of a man.
He's 6'6" and he's got this kind of, you know, razor cut jaw and this huge white teeth, and he's very, very, very charismatic, very charismatic. And he holds these events all around the world, and thousands of people come to the stadium, and you spend 3 days with Tony, and he kind of whips you up into what he calls a peak state. So through music and through his kind of talking to you, and you do all these, like, get up and dance, and he just gets you into this state where you believe anything is possible, quite secret, like, in that way, like, that you're capable of anything. And apparently he modeled himself on, he studied evangelical preachers in the States, and rock stars. Was there a third thing he modeled? I can't remember. But he captures an audience so amazingly. And one of the things that he talks a lot about is, you know, this mind over matter. And he gets you to believe so much that anything is possible, you run over a lane of burning coals. So I think the event I was at, there was maybe 3,000-4,000 people there. And I think the vast majority, we piled out into the car park of the Excel Centre in East London, under the glow of the nearby Travelodge Hotel. And you queued up in the dark and run across these lanes of burning coals. And, you know, afterwards, the fact that you've done that is like quite hard to get your head around. How did I do that? How did I even, you know, did it happen? It was so easy.
But he whips you up into a frenzy.
It's kind of a frenzy.
Music and exactly. atmosphere, and there is this whole exactly. group thing going on. Yeah, yeah. It's And I do think you liken it to a cult.
I don't know about the word cult. Like,
but did you use the word cult in that?
I think my flatmate might have done.
Maybe that's what it was.
I can't remember if I did. I don't know. Anyway, I need to investigate more what a cult actually is, or. It's a very easy word to throw around at people in situations, and
In fairness, I often say, you know, when people talk about, you know, loved ones being taken into a religious cult, and the very person talking about it may be part of the Catholicism. And I'm kind of going, well, Catholicism is a cult, you know.
So this is it, exactly that. But in terms of the money, so I think I paid
500, I think.
That was probably something like that.
Others paid 1,200.
I was in the cheaper seat. You paid more to be closer to Tony. You could also pay more to have a photograph with Tony. And a good section of that three or four day event, I can't remember now, is spent trying to upsell you to the more expensive week-long retreats he does in his private island in Fiji. And
And I think in the book you said there were 7,000 people at the event.
Was there? Yeah.
Yeah, because I think Rachel, your friend in the book, asks you that.
Exactly. Like
this is what's lovely, in the book is that your friends ask you the questions that you as the reader want to ask. Well, hold on a second. How many were there? How much money did you make out of that event?
Yeah, so I came home from that event just madly in love with Tony Robbins, thinking he was the answer to everything. And Rachel, just exactly like you said, how many people are there and how much is the tickets? And then she did the maths and she's like, if Tony Robbins is such an amazing man that wants to save the world, why is he charging so much for these tickets? Why doesn't he just let everybody in? And at the time I was really annoyed at her questioning him. I was really annoyed because I thought he was so amazing. And I still actually think his information is fantastic, but it's a really big industry. The self-help industry is a huge industry.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the figure. Is it 1.5 billion or something was the figure that was the last estimate of what it's worth. And that industry is built on the fact that you don't just buy one book and you don't just go on one weekend retreat, you go on the next one, the next one, the next one, the next one. And at Tony, there were people putting things, buying the next thing on credit card. Mm-hmm. And the message was always, this is an investment in yourself. And we would get, people coming up on stage and talking about how they were homeless and now that they did a Tony Robbins week and now they've got private jets.
But if they were homeless, how could they afford to do a Tony Robbins week?
But I mean, I don't know. I can't remember how money would come to them or whether they would borrow, beg, steal and borrow, and it would be the thing. And I don't discount that all of that is possible. It's a very intoxicating atmosphere to be in.
Oh, I remember that, but yeah. I didn't go to any of the events, but I remember feeling really inspired by the book. And you also read Louise Hay. And I mean, my copy of Louise Hay, I still have it. I haven't read it for 20 years, I'm sure. And my copy was so well read, all the pages have fallen apart.
Yeah.
And that's one of your last books that you read. I now look back at a lot of these books, now that, because I wouldn't have been a psychologist at that point. I wouldn't have been to university and I wouldn't have the knowledge that I have now. But I believed a lot of this stuff, and I also would have Deepak Chopra. I would have read loads of his stuff, Seven Spiritual Laws of Success. And, I was seeking stuff. I probably actually would have been around your age. I would have been in my 30s. And I think that's a particularly interesting decade of your life. I think turning 30 is actually one of the critical, it's actually more challenging than turning 40 and 50 and, because I suppose we're such an ageist society and it's the first sort of serious age turn. And you start to question yourself. And really, in hindsight, as you get older, you realize how very young you are at that point. Your 30s, you're still very young. And it's funny, when I was listening to your book and you were talking about, I don't know what I want. I don't know. And then you kind of go, well, you know what? You're only 30. Life is actually discovering what you want. I'm really only like a lot of us, you live life and it's during that journey. Sorry, Mom, I'm at the journey thing again. But it is during that journey that you actually learn what you love. Now, I happened to, and possibly I did it, sorry, Dave, my husband, but, I followed that pattern. You meet a man, you get married. And I did that very, very young. Now, fortunately, I married a very good man, which is probably one of the most important things to do, I would say, that goodness is important. And I actually interviewed one of my guests on the earliest podcast. She wrote a fabulous book, if ever you read it, Hilary Fannin. And it really explores that about, falling in love with, this fantastic, beautiful man and ending up with this good man. And it's a fabulous book. really is. The Weight of Love, it's called.
If you've never,
yeah, if you've never read it, and it spans actually Ireland and London, and I think you'll it's a beautiful book, really fabulous. Yeah. Anyway, I'm digressing on that, but so I kind of did all that, and that's what struck me, because basically a lot of your self-help journey and one of your self-help books was about taking risks. And you know, so many of your friends were saying, you know, and assuming, as a lot of people and a lot of my listeners are in their 20s and 30s, this pressure that you should be partnered up or married or having babies. And I have quite a few friends actually who've never had children. And that pressure that either there's something wrong or you can't have children, or actually I even took part in a documentary with Joanne McNally, the comedian, and how people viewed her as a baby hater because she made a comment that she didn't think she ever wanted to have children, you know. The pressure that is felt there, and you know, it's funny, I mean, your book really got me thinking, and I love a book that does that. It's really thought-provoking that people from the outside in viewing you are saying, Marianne, why do you want to change? Yeah. You're so successful, right? This resonated with me. The thing about success is that when you achieve something, it's done. You have your little buzz and then it's done and it's the next thing. And one of the things you learned on the journey is it's actually really not about getting there. You know, it's not about arriving. It's the journey there, because actually you've got to keep striving, because you achieve that thing and that's that buzz, and you need to have something else. And that's really good for your brain health and your mental health and your life. So that also gives the sense that when you've already done something, that's done. What have I achieved? If you know what I mean, because you don't carry that buzz around you all the time. But from the outside, people are looking at you, oh my God, because there's one incident where you're feeling really down and your friend says, but you've got three articles on the newsstand, you know, and two newspapers, and you're going, yeah, but you know, that's rubbish or whatever.
Yeah.
And I've had that feeling as well, you know, people saying, oh, but you were in a soap opera and you were, you know, in this, and you kind of go, yeah, but that's done. And I got that feeling actually when you were talking about, you know, but you know, I haven't got a partner, or, and people were focusing on, oh, you've got to find a man, or you've got to ask someone out. And I'm kind of going, but the funny thing is, once you meet someone and get married, you know, well, that's done. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of funny. But when you haven't done it yet, so while you were waiting to get a job as a journalist, that seemed like the biggest thing in the world. But then once you get it, there's something else you need to look for, you know? It's just society and media. And I really don't think it helps that all our movies and our books put so much emphasis on romantic love as the be all and end all, because at the end of the day, the romantic love bit of it doesn't actually last very long. You know, films and movies and stuff are kind of lying in that. What lasts very long is a really deep love that's very similar to friendship and family love. And, you know, it's about caring for people, and that can come from lots of different sources. Well,
this is the source of my second book.
Excellent.
Yeah, the second book is called Love Me, and it's the subtitle is One Woman's Search for a New Happy Ever After. And it's just about this unpacking of the romantic myth of having to go off into the sunset with someone, and that's never happened for me. And why is that? Is it because I'm doing something wrong, or is it because there's actually many different ways to live a life, and I am living the life that's best suited to me? And so it explores all of this.
And you see, what struck me as well, like, I was very envious. I've been married for a very long time. I mean, I was married since 1987, but I was very envious of the love you have, which is, you know, from the outside, people might say, oh, look, you have that. But I'm so envious of the love you have with your mother. I never had that with my mother. You know, I'm very envious of that. Very envious of the love. I have lovely friends as well, but and I do have, but some of your friends, the love and the understanding and the deep loyalty, that's incredible. Yeah. you know,
I'm really, really genuinely blessed. So romantic love has never gone my way. Friendship, I have just been so blessed with.
You're drowning in friendship, really, I would say. Yeah.
Deep loving friendships. I really do. And I work at them and they work at it with me. You know, we drive each other mad sometimes, but like that seems to be something that's and I know not everyone finds that easy. That's something that doesn't happen for a lot of people. There's this idea that friends are just these sort of natural things that people have, but a lot of people, I wrote an article about this, a lot of people don't have close friends, and it's a source of embarrassment because that's something they find hard, whereas a partnership they might have again fallen into quite easily when they were younger, but friendship is something they haven't. I have been very lucky in friendship, and I'm really lucky with my mum. I suppose part of what the first book was about, and I've repeated that same mistake in the second book, but the first book, a lot of it is about focusing on things that I don't have and missing everything that I have.
Yeah.
Which was so much. And I look back, so the book came out in 2018 and we're 2022 now. And I've done a few interviews again about the book recently. It's funny, it had been quiet and it's starting again. So I look back on some of my earlier interviews almost to revise, you know.
Yeah, what the book is about. You forget what you've written. Yeah.
I look at myself, you know, on these TV interviews things, and I just think, oh, I look so young and I'm so articulate. And I kind of, but it makes me thinking, what was your problem? Why did you do any of that?
Yes.
Why did you?
Yes. Because I've been looking at images of you and I'm kind of going, you almost sound like you've body dysmorphia because you just look so amazing. But I find that about myself as well. Every time I look back in time, and I'm always still though, this is what's wonderful, folks, if you do listen to or read the book. Marianne reveals her internal dialogue, which is so like my internal dialogue. And I am sure it is identical to your internal dialogue. Yeah. This constant self-criticism that we all, this, you know, and it's something I'm interested, and it's something that I'm going to be writing about in my next book as well, you know, which really is going to be about manifesting, but from a neuroscientific perspective. But you know, this constant critique that we have of ourselves. But what is wonderful is about the way the honest way that you shared it, because I think this huge comfort to be gained from that when you read that is you kind of go, oh, that's exactly what I say. You know. And the funny thing is that you've just said, looking back on that, like I gained, like a lot of people, a lot of weight during the pandemic. And I've never felt so heavy in my life, and so much of my identity is pinned on how slim I am. And I can pinpoint that back to my teens. I was never aware or conscious. I was always a skinny child. My bones stuck out everywhere. I never ate very much. I wasn't interested in food. And then I remember in my teens overhearing guys saying what a fabulous body I had and how, you know, I remember thinking actually it was a horrible thing to say, but what a great bum I had. And I thought, what a disgusting thing to say about. But I soon learned, you know, oh, that was actually a good thing sort of thing, you know.
Yes.
And so my sense of being attractive was always related to how good my body looked. And that has never changed. So when I carry weight, I think that means I become completely and utterly unattractive.
It
just doesn't relate to anything else. And so I feel completely unattractive when I carry weight. There's rare times when I feel the ideal weight. But now that I feel overweight and I look back and I go, oh my God, look at me there. I look lovely. And I thought I was grossly overweight there. And now I'm really grossly overweight. And then you look back and you keep looking back and you just have this constant overcritical sense of who you are. But there's one thing I do want to say that also is something that I learned a little bit later in life. And I think we do eventually come to learn these things. And that's what you know, you had this constant thing about how could anyone find me attractive? Mm. And then you have this lovely line, because you were aware that you smiled a lot.
Yeah.
And you have this lovely interaction with this Greek. And I'm kind of loath to talk about it because I don't want to spoil that story in it. But I do want to ask you a question, and maybe I'll ask you off camera not to. But it's akin to it's a bit of a Greek tragedy in a way in some parts. But then you do have this wonderful line, which I believe is very true. And my listeners know how passionate I am about smiling. And you just said, maybe it's not that, I think it's something like that people are braver than me, or that they're more attractive. Maybe they just smile at other people more. And that is proven in research. People who smile are considered more attractive, and people will approach people who smile more than any other people, because it's related to the fear response. It's okay to approach that person. If you have a grumpy face on, it's aversive, we'll go the other way, you know?
Yeah, because I had this this idea that I was single because I wasn't good looking enough, and that I didn't have blonde hair, and I was whatever. And then I had this moment where I had this conversation with a man, and he said that it's quite sort of a logical approach to it, but he said if a woman smiled at him three times, that was when he knew he could approach her. And so then I have this moment of maybe they're not all just like better than me, maybe they're just smiling more. But when I'm confronted, or confronted is a telling word, but if I'm with a man or see a man that I fancy, I'm so scared and stressed, I'm not smiling at him.
Yeah.
Whereas the rest of the world, I smile a lot. And that's probably partly why I make friends easily. When it comes to someone that I'm attracted to, I don't, you know.
What do you think? I mean, you do freeze when you find. So the fear response is often described as fight or flight. And people forget, actually, the fear response freeze. Has three points, and freeze is. And you do seem to freeze. In that instant. And have you any idea, because you don't discuss this in the book, have you any idea why you think you really freeze?
Well, I don't know. I went to an all-girl school. I'm one of three sisters. It was a Catholic school where, you know, the message was if you got raped and you got pregnant, you had to keep the child because it was what God wanted. I think there was just this combination when I was a younger girl of always just not being in my world very much, you know, and then our first understanding of them was
they might do bad things.
Yes. And I have male friends and they're wonderful. So in lots of ways, this isn't the case. But when it comes to that, there's a guardedness that I have around men that I absolutely don't have around women. And in some ways that's dropped. In some situations that's not there. And then in other situations it really is. So yeah, it's an area of my life that I'm still not easy in.
Yeah. And there's some really interesting stuff. I won't go into it all, but it's really interesting from a psychological perspective in terms of how little one-liners that our parents say, like your mum saying, oh, you're always so independent, I never thought that you'd settle down or whatever. And how they can actually, you know, enter our psyche and may have huge influence on our life. I do, we've gone just over the hour and I really appreciate your time, but I do want you to mention, because you really did find Eckhart's book. And it'd be nice for you found that really transformative. And
yes, it would be
remiss of me not to allow you sort of mention that.
The Power of Now was really my favorite book, and I'm sure lots of people know it. But at this point, it was one of my final books, and I had really come unstuck after a year and a bit trying to be perfect and realizing that I was a mess still. And The Power of Now, and also Brené Brown's Daring Greatly, they were two really wonderful books. The Power of Now, a bit like you were referring to this sort of internal criticism that I had constantly going on, The Power of Now was the first time I read a description of that in a book, and it made me realize, first of all, I didn't even know that he says that they're like records, that we put on these records every morning. There's the I'm fat record, the I'm lazy record, the no one fancies me record, the I'm a shit writer record, the I'm boring record, these thoughts that will repeat and repeat and repeat, but they're so normal to us, we don't even realize they're there. So The Power of Now was the first time that I was like, oh my God, this is what I'm saying to myself every single day. And I wrote down some of the records and what I was saying. And then I was thinking, God, well, no wonder I'm, you know, I get physically sick, I get worn down very easily, and I've had periods of depression. It's like, well, no wonder I'm poisoning myself every day with the things I'm telling myself. And so he says that, you know, we all have these records, and there's sort of peace in just accepting that too, that this is part of the kind of dysfunctional part
it's
of being
part of the human condition.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that in a weird way is like, there's no cure in that, but it's a relief in just going, oh, okay, this is what we do. Because he says that humans are quite insane, that, you know, we're the only species to just kill each other in at mass and to almost never feel happy in the present moment. So he says his thing
it's
is
language that, in a way, language has given us the capacity to imagine to imagine futures that may never happen. And that takes yeah. us out of the present. So swans can mate for life and they grieve as much as we do, but they don't imagine what it would be like if their partner died. They're too busy living their life in the moment. But if their partner does die, they will grieve. Whereas we have the capacity to keep imagining that that might happen in the future. And that's language allows us to do that. And our thinking process, I think, allows us to do that. And that's where we get all caught up in mental illness. But we control our thoughts, and we can let them drift, as Eckhart sort of says, or you can change,
the
record. Yeah.
One of the really helpful things that he says is, so he says that when you see people walking down the street and they're talking to themselves, you know, we think they're mad, but we're all doing that all the time. And so just to realize that, but he says also the other thing that we do is that we, just like you were saying there, that we're either constantly rushing ahead to the future, either that things are going to be magically better in the future or potentially worse, or we're living in the past, rehashing all the things we should have, would have, could have done differently. And we never live in the only place that he says brings us peace and calm, which is in the current moment.
Yeah.
And up at this point, like, mindfulness was very big, and I would kind of roll my eyes with all this be in the now stuff. I didn't really know what it meant until I read The Power of Now, and then I really, really got it. And he says, you know, if you ask yourself at any given moment, do I have a problem right now, this second? So right now, this second, we're having this lovely conversation. I am healthy. I'm safe. Right now, there is absolutely no problem. But of course, in my head, I could be doing a whole number of, like, why didn't you say this, or what's going to happen next month? But to constantly bring it back, do I have a problem right now, this second? No. Okay, breathe. And he says that when we do have problems, you know, when the worst happens, we get sick, someone dies, we usually amaze ourselves at how well we do get through it. You know, it's not that it's not painful, but we actually, something kicks in and we get through it. And so the power of
we're incredibly adaptable.
And resilient. And so then I did that book, and I just had moments of pure peace in it, and an understanding of how it is possible to just.
And I should say to the listeners that it was very important, because throughout the journey towards, you know, sort of after about sort of maybe 9 or 10 months, you became very ill in terms of very, very depressed. And it's not surprising, because you were spending all of your time self-analyzing. You were actually never in the present moment, to be perfectly honest. And I advocate for present moment, and I often say to people, look, you don't have to do mindfulness exercises, it doesn't have to be meditation, it doesn't have to be that, but spend time in the present moment. But you also have to plan, and you can learn from the past, but, you know, find things where you can lose yourself in the present, because in losing yourself, that's where you find yourself, because it sounds like an oxymoron, but it's the truth. In doing, taking on this, and it's exactly like the therapist that you ended up going to said, you were doing experiments without any what we call supervision, which is without offloading or explaining what was happening. And actually, if you'd been doing that, someone would have said to you, you have to stop, because this is making you unwell. And basically, you were never in the present moment. You were constantly putting yourself under huge pressure and threat, which is why I think it should have a little label that says do not try this at home, because it was way too much for any single
I didn't understand what I was doing to myself. I hadn't ever had therapy. I had no psychological awareness, really, so I didn't understand.
And especially if you had a tendency towards depression. And also, actually, something that I found it's funny, I have listeners all around the world. The bulk of my listeners, my core listeners, are pretty much 50-50 Irish and UK. And I think what's really interesting, because you've grown up in the UK, but then you've an Irish heritage, and I wonder whether some of, and I'd love to hear back from people, but whether some of the things that you've said and some of your baggage, for want of a better word, is uniquely Irish.
Because I think
some of it really feels really uniquely Irish.
But then it's interesting
but your book has been global.
The Irish Catholic guilt, I think, is such a core part of my personality, going to a convent school, and I think it's very Irish. And then in other ways it mustn't be, because the book has been, I think it's in 31 languages.
Congratulations.
Thanks. And I get messages, it came out last summer in Iran, and wow. I get messages from people in Iran.
But saying, you see a female repressed kind of culture.
That's true. And also,
but then
Russia.
Again, I suppose around the globe, females have been repressed and are becoming more repressed when you look in the United States.
I hadn't thought of it through that light, but the message basically from every country in the world, and all the countries that's come in, has been along the lines of, it was like reading myself.
Yeah.
And so that makes me think that, yes, in some ways it's very Irish. Yes, in some ways it's very Catholic. And in other ways, maybe it's just human.
I think it's human. I think I've actually said, so my husband has dyslexia, and he'd never read a book until lockdown, really. He'd read one or two that were mainly just soccer biographies. And I said to him, look, you have to listen to Audible. It's amazing. And he put it off for a very long time because he thought it just was someone. And then she went, and then he didn't realize that books are amazing, and they come to life and they're acted out and everything. So I was listening to this yesterday evening and I was just laughing out loud. And I would like you to tell the story about your uncle when he died and Amy Winehouse. And I was laughing out loud. And he said, I thought you were working. I said, I am. I can't wait to talk to this woman tomorrow. And I should say that, folks, the book is full of humor. And I had laugh out loud moments, because it's that laugh out loud at yourself and the connection and how, oh my God, I do that. Or, oh, I can't believe she did that. And I said, oh, you have to listen to this. So I'm giving it. He's going to listen to it next. And I know that he will love it. And I'm curious, did you hear a lot from guys who've read it?
So this is really interesting, because the book opens with the lines, like, there comes a point in a woman's life when she realizes things can't carry on as they are. And I was interviewed, one of the very first interviews I did for the book was in Holland, and I've been invited to speak at this big festival, and there's this male TV presenter that was interviewing me on a stage, and his first question, it really stayed with me. He said, why didn't you say there comes a time in every person's life when you realize, because he said, I related to everything in your book, I'm not a woman. And so it's definitely more female readers than male readers, but I get messages from men very regularly. It's a human experience. And I think for men, the pressure that is on them might be slightly different forms of pressure to the one that I might feel as a woman. They have different expectations on them. But I get messages from male readers.
And that's encouraging to hear, I think, as well, you know, that it is the human experience. But I do think women buy more self-help books.
We do, men. The statistics show that. But there's also, self-help is a funny genre, because some books will be put under self-help, but then there's also this branch called smart thinking, which you could say is self-help, but put in a more business context. And a lot of business books are actually self-help books. And a lot of the kind of more scientific, the self-help content that's packaged as this sort of success manuals for men. There's Yeah, there's, I think there's different pressures on men and different pressures on women. And I wonder how much that's changing. But for me as a woman, the idea was always, as a woman, that my job was to be pretty and nice. And and for men, there's different pressures, which is, I guess, to be successful and to be big and to be strong and
powerful. But
yeah, powerful, exactly, which is a lot of pressure on them too, I think. So yes, there we go. Self-help. I do have male readers, but yeah, traditionally the genre, as we know, self-help tends to be a more female.
It tends to be a more female. Yeah. Audience. Look, it has been. I could talk to you forever, Marianne. It has been just such an absolute pleasure talking to you. I like to end this podcast. Really, is about surviving and thriving in life. Yeah. And your whole book is about that. I'm going to ask you if it's at all possible to give us just one tip about surviving and or thriving in life that you can share with our listeners.
Is to be honest with somebody about how you're feeling right now. Just to be honest. I did so many weird and wonderful, brilliant things in the book, and the moments that were the most special were these unexpected, honest conversations that I would have with my friends, with taxi drivers, with someone at a bus stop about what was going on and what was worrying me and what was hurting. And those conversations were just so beautiful, because almost, and it's a bit like you were saying when you read the book, and I am honest in it. And all I ever find with honesty is to be met with someone who goes, me too, me too. And it's the most lovely thing. Your problem will still be there, and somehow it doesn't feel so bad. It just feels like, well, there we go, we're human.
Yeah, and it's the problem shared. And actually, yeah, you got to read it, even just for that moment sharing with the one particular taxi driver was
he changed my life, that taxi
driver. Yeah, incredible. And I felt... Yeah. I mean, and I have found that myself. You know, often we tend to write off taxi drivers, but sometimes there are incredible individuals sitting driving you around. Yeah, they do know humans, and they have interacted with so many humans, and often they have incredible stories and incredible insight and incredible wisdom. The book is called
Help Me.
Thank you. You just helped me.
In case it didn't come across in the interview, I absolutely loved Marianne's book, Help Me, and highly recommend it. Get yourself a copy if you can. I particularly enjoyed the Audible edition. It was lovely to hear Marianne reading it herself, and also to hear her mum chirping in with her little pieces of wisdom. I found it funny, I found it poignant, and I also found it really thought-provoking. But I do genuinely think it should come with a don't try this at home warning. You know, essentially Marianne carried out an experiment on herself, and it did have dire consequences. She did make herself very ill. My name is Sabina Brennan, and you have been listening to Superbrain, the podcast for everyone with a brain.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.